Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Sunday, May 13th, 2018, Mother's Day. This is episode 1488. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Quip, the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Visit getquip.com/twit to get your first refill pack free when you purchase any Quip electric toothbrush. And by LastPass. Join over 13 million LastPass users and start managing and securing your passwords today. Learn more at LastPass.com/twit. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk computers and the internet and home theater, digital photography, you know, smartphones, smartwatches, all that rigmarole. 8888 Ask Leo is the phone number. If you have a question, a comment, a suggestion, you want to talk high tech. It's not really, you know, I think sometimes people think this is a tech support, like a way to get through the tech support line that you can't get through with the manufacturer. Not really. Let's talk about technology issues in general, stuff that would everybody be interested in. How about that? 8888 Ask Leo. We put everything I talk about on the show on the website, techguylabs.com. That's free. No sign up. techguylabs.com. You'll find everything there. We talked yesterday about Google I.O., the Google Developers Conference, which was this past week. Same with Microsoft's Developers Conference. They call it Build. That's a good name. I like that. I don't know what I.O. has to do with anything, but Build, that's a good name. And then Apple's, in great Silicon Valley tradition, is an acronym, WWDC, Worldwide Developers Conference. And that's coming up in about 2.5 weeks. My wife was looking at her laptop, her Mac laptop, this morning, and said, "When are the new laptops coming out?" I said, "That one's not that old. What's wrong?" "No, it's slow. I want a new one." She has a MacBook, you know, the really thin and light, and they are kind of slow, but that's why they're thin and light, you know. And maybe they would be faster if they had newer chips in them, something like that. So I said, "What I always say, I don't know." Apple doesn't call me and say, "Hey, Leo, you might," but this would be a bad time to buy a Mac laptop. I think it would be prudent to wait until the first week in June when Apple may or may not, but most likely will, announce new laptops. They commonly do, and they're due. It's time. It's right. The time is right to do it. So the consensus is June 4th, the opening day of WWDC, Apple probably say something. I wouldn't expect new iPads, but it's possible, but I wouldn't expect that. And I definitely don't think there'll be new iPhones announced. What you mostly see at the developers conference every summer from Apple is a preview of the next version of Mac OS and iOS. It will be iOS 12. And Mac OS has gotten into the deep decimals at this point. I'm not sure. I guess it's 10.14. 10.14.0. Whatever California landmark they used to name it. So that's probably prudent if you're thinking about buying a Mac laptop, but I wouldn't wait if you want an iPhone or an iPad. I wouldn't wait. Apple Watch, there are rumors there'll be a new Apple Watch. You know, the best rumor, though, is there'll be a new Android watch from Google, a new Pixel watch. Google's never made any Android Wear watches. And frankly, there's not been a lot of news about Android Wear. Until last week, Qualcomm said, "Yeah, we're working on a new chip." All the Android Wear watches have the same old chip they've had, for the last few years in them. We're working on a new, faster, better chip, better battery life. That's the real thing you want with these watches. And Google says nothing. No, Google says nothing. But the Google leakers say there will be new Pixel watches. Typically, time frame around October. Sometime this fall. That's the typical time frame for Google's announcement. So there, I've got all of the developers' conferences out of the way. Nothing more to see here. You can move on. Let's see, what else is big in the news? Not a whole lot. That really kind of ate up the week. I was a little disappointed to see the New York Times reported. You have to understand a little bit about the law to understand this story. If law enforcement wants to listen in on your calls, they have to get a warrant in this country. They have to get a judge to say, yes, there's probable cause of a crime and you can tap the phones. And it's really tough to get that. And, well, I think it's supposed to be anyway. And you have to really prove that there's some merit to the case and there is probable cause and all of that. But there are things law enforcement can find out about you without a warrant, without going to a judge, without really doing much of anything. And one of them, now thanks to smartphones, is to see where you are at any given time. You know, Perry Mason, remember, did you ever watch Perry Mason? You young people never even heard of him. But it was a great courtroom TV show. When was that? The 70s? And, you know, he was a lawyer. And it was always, you know, they had a big denouement at the end of every show where, you know, it was in the courtroom. And sometimes it would be, where were you, sir, on the night of October 14th, 2012? Where were you, sir? Well, now, you know, they don't never need to ask that question because you have a tracking device on you. That was another thing you'd see a lot in movies and TV, you know, the spy sneaking up behind the car and slapping the magnetic tracking device. They don't need to do that. You got a phone, right? Phone's got a GPS. The phone's always connected. And it turns out there's a company called Securus. Kind of an ironic name, actually. Securus. They, for a long time, they're one of the largest providers of phones for prisons. Who knew? This is a huge business. It's very expensive, I guess, if you're in prison to make a phone call. And these companies that do this make a lot of money. But the other thing they do, of course, is they give law enforcement the ability to listen in on those calls. You're in prison. You don't have any rights. And they can now, Securus has a new kind of a sideline. A little extra something-something that they're offering law enforcement for free. You can find out where pretty much any cell phone in the country is within seconds or has been. And it does this, according to the New York Times, by going through a system that's typically used by marketers. It seems like marketers have had this ability for a while. AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, Verizon, they all cooperate. This came to light because there was a sheriff in Mississippi County, Missouri, a guy named Corey Hutchison, he's not there anymore, who used this Securus service between 2014 and 2017 11 times, not to target bad guys, but to target, among others, a judge, members of the highway patrol. He's pleaded not guilty in that case, but he was dismissed in an unrelated matter earlier in the year. Law enforcement. And Securus says, hey, it's not our job. We're neither judge nor district attorney. The responsibility of ensuring the legal adequacy of supporting documentation lies with our law enforcement customers and their counsel. In other words, if you're in law enforcement, go right ahead. We assume that you're doing the right thing. So, there's a lot of good uses for that. Grandpa, has Alzheimer's, gets lost. You can't figure out where he is. You can go to the police and they can say, if grandpa's got a phone, well, here's where he is. We know exactly where he is. So that's good. On the other hand, seems like without a warrant, by the way, there's all sorts of other stuff they can see without a warrant, including the metadata from your phone calls, who you called, when you called. That they don't need a warrant for that. Who you sent emails to. That kind of thing. All of that's kind of deemed to be fair game. It's good to know. Good to know. I use cheap charging pads all the time. This is the one I recommend. NeoCities is asking about, or Noodles, I'm sorry, is asking about these. This is the one I use, and I actually bought a few more because they've lowered the price on these. This is the Tilt VU. TYLTVU. I think it's now down to $30. This is a nice charging pad because I prefer, I don't like pads because the phone can slip off, but these are very, you know, it's hard not to get the phone in the right position. And they have three charging coils, so you can also charge sideways if you want, which is really great if you like to watch movies or something like that. So this, and this is a nice cheap charging pad, the one I recommend. I don't know what happened to Apple's. I don't really like the pad charging pads. The, you know, the ones that look like this. This is actually a good one because it's Samsung's. And this, which I don't like, but then you could do this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, shaking all night long. Well, not really. In fact, really, I just woke up. You get to a certain age.
You don't shake all night long.
All that
anymore.
Party stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Really, it's getting a little rough
on really
me these
happy.
Days.
Yeah, it doesn't really happen. Hi, Kim Schaffer.
Good morning.
Welcome. Let's see. You've been answering the phone since the break of dawn. Night long.
No, I needed to take a little rest. I only got here a few minutes ago.
There's plenty of calls.
Who
should I start with?
How about Walt in Irvine has what probably a lot of us have, a ton of CDs, and he's thinking of starting some kind of music server.
Does
and what's your advice?
AC/DC CDs?
He probably does have ACDC.
Probably does.
Don't we all?
Thank you, Kim. Hello, Walt.
Hello, Leo.
How are you? Welcome. Happy Mother's Day.
Well,
yeah, I know. We're not mothers, but that's okay.
Yeah.
We may be mothers. Yeah, I don't know. In another sense. What can I do for you?
Well, doing downsizing, and I'm looking in my cabinets. I have about 150 CDs, and I'm thinking instead of moving them, I'll donate them, but I'd like to consider putting them on some kind of music server. I like, you know, like the iTunes interface. I'm used to using that. I'm sort of a Mac guy. So I was thinking maybe using a Mac Mini or something like that.
Sure, yeah.
Reading them all in. What do I have to, is there another alternative?
Well, there are many alternatives. So first of all, the music industry, on behalf of the music industry, they would probably like me to tell you that you shouldn't donate those. You should destroy them because, of course,
I knew.
If you give them away, then somebody else didn't buy it, and I don't know. Anyway, that was just obligation. I said it at an obligation.
Yeah.
I don't care what you do with it. You should rip them, in my opinion, you should rip them in a lossless format. Rip means not rip off.
Yeah.
Again, the music industry would like you to think that, but that's merely taking and digitizing it. And I like to digitize them in a format called FLAC, but there are other lossless formats. FLAC is probably the most common, and it's open source, so it'll be around. And the reason you do that is it does compress. It gets to about half the size. But you can also reconstitute the CD-ROM. You could even burn a CD in exactly the same quality. If you rip them as AAC or MP3s, you're losing some quality and you can never get that CD quality back. So given that you want an archive of this CD, do it in a format that is lossless. Now, if you're going to use iTunes, then iTunes does have a music server built into it. You'll probably want to use Apple's lossless, which is Apple's own lossless codec. And you can, when you rip CDs with iTunes, you can choose that in the settings. And it's compatible enough. You can convert from Apple lossless to FLAC easily enough. So that's fine, too. Now, you could use iTunes itself as a server, but you'd have to do exactly what you just described, which is get a Mac that's going to stay on all the time and put that on the network. But you can also get, and I think this is probably a better solution, something called a network attached storage device, or NAS. Yeah. It's not a full computer. You know, the Mac Mini has a lot of features that you won't be using.
No.
So if you get a network attached storage, it's really designed to be a vast storage device. Mm-hmm. And on the network, but headless. It doesn't have a keyboard, mouse, or monitor. So you work with it over the internet using your browser on another computer.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things a good NAS will have, most NASs will do this, is a variety of media-serving software, including iTunes-compatible servers. But there's also some that will work with other devices. And if you want to be most flexible, you might look at using – I mean, any NAS – network attached storage device will have iTunes, it'll have Windows Media Server, and it'll probably have Plex or the capability of Plex. And Plex is usually what I recommend. It doesn't just serve music. It also can serve video. So you can serve movies up and TV shows. And Plex works on everything you could use. I mean, there's Plex on Roku, Apple TV, of course, on your computer. On every device, you can get a Plex client for. So that means you'll be able to play that music anywhere. You can even put it online if you want so that you could go on the road and download it streaming that way. So the advantage of that also is that Plex's interface, if you do put it on a Roku or an Apple TV, is on the screen. Plex will put the album art, information about the album, lots of nice stuff that you wouldn't get. Yeah. So I would look at, my favorite brand is Synology.
Synology.
They're not cheap. Synology. The reason I like them is because the capabilities are very rich. You'll end up, what'll happen if you get a NAS is you'll end up using it for more than just serving music. You may then start doing TV and film. You might then start using it as a backup device. You can go on and on. So it's,
yeah, because I have my, I also have about 20 DVDs.
There you go. Rip those too.
Ripped up, but I rip them in the FLAC format, is what you're saying?
Yeah, DVDs are, you wouldn't use FLAC. You just, but for music, use FLAC or AIFF. If you're using Plex, it understands every format. So
does it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And it'll be cheaper than a Mac Mini, or at least no more expensive, and probably have massive capacity compared to a Mac Mini. That's one of the things about these NASs. Typically, they have multiple hard drives, and so you can get really, you know, terabytes of storage, which means you've got a lot of room for expansion.
Fantastic. That sounds... Now, what's the output? Is it a PCM output, or is it an audio? What's the output of the this NAS device?
Well, if it's... So you're going to have a server that's serving the media. Mm-hmm. So on the other end, you'll have a client that receives the media, and most media servers will let you choose. Yeah, it's probably PCM, but it could be Dolby encoded. It could be MP3. There's a lot of different ways to do it, and that will be configurable in the media server. So you get to choose what you want.
Great. Well, that sounds like a viable alternative. A friend of mine was going to give me a Mac Mini, but...
Well, a free Mac Mini, it's hard to turn down.
Yeah.
I'm not... I don't want to look a gift mini in the mouth, but but you can run Plex on a Mac Mini, by the way, as well.
Yeah.
So if you get a free one, then maybe that's a good solution. But you'll notice, I mean, you can't put as much storage in there. You'll have to have an external drive. By the time you put it all together, sometimes it's better to just do a NAS.
I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
It's a very popular thing. A lot of people are doing this these days. Plex is at plex.tv if you want to read more about it. It's probably now, I would guess, far and away the most popular media server out there. But, you know, maybe not, just because there's so many Macs out there that maybe iTunes, you know, just by virtue of having a huge installed base of Macs, maybe iTunes, maybe even Windows Media Server because of all the Windows machines. But when people are actually using it to do streaming media, to do serve content up, I think they choose, when they're actively, you know, aware of it, they choose Plex, I would say, for the most part. It's pretty, pretty good. Pretty, pretty nice. Synology is one of many NAS companies. You hear me recommend them all the time. They're not a sponsor. In fact, I've spent a lot of money buying Synology NASs, but they're quite good. I think they're very good. But there's others. What are some of the other ones? I used to use a ReadyNAS for a long time. Lots of choices. 8888 Ask Leo is the phone number. Let's see. We're going to visit with, I think, if Chris Marquardt's back from his trip, we'll visit with Chris Marquardt in about an hour, our photo guide, talk about digital photography. And we will take more of your calls right after this. QNAP, somebody's saying. Drobo. Yeah. Also good choices. And now to line two, the smart call from John in Las Vegas. Hello, John.
Hey, Leo. How's it going?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing good. I built a Windows 10 machine, and I had a Windows 7 upgrade license, which I used. And then
that's interesting. So you put Windows 7 on the machine first, and then upgraded it.
Yeah, I had an upgrade license.
That's a good way to do it. Yeah.
Right. So then I did upgrade to a Windows 10. And then the problem that I'm having is that when I watch videos on YouTube, I tend to notice the system starts slowing down and then ultimately it freezes.
No kidding.
And, Yeah. Once that happens, I can't really do a reboot or exit any programs, and I'm forced to do a hard reboot.
Oh, that's not good. So it slows down to the point where you really can't even use it, it sounds like.
That's correct.
And it's nothing else that you do causes this, just watching videos on YouTube?
Yes, that's the only thing that I noticed. I mean, when I'm using regular Microsoft Office products or just web surfing or doing email, I don't notice any difference.
Wow.
Yeah.
Have you tried going to other sites with video on them to see, you know, CNN or Vimeo or something like that, just to see if it's video?
I do have one of those Cox Contour programs where I can watch TV online. And I haven't really noticed any problems there.
Interesting. Because my first reaction would be, well, it sounds like you've got some, you know, video does use the system in ways that is a little bit different from, you know, just browsing the web or getting email. So it's possible that whatever is happening when you're watching the YouTube videos is happening because of the video. But that seems a little odd. YouTube, let me think. Kind of depends how you've set up the machine. Some machines, the graphics card just blasts video onto the screen. You might want to look just, I don't know, this might be a diagnostic value. And who knows, it might even fix it. There's a setting buried deep within the video driver called accelerated graphics. And you might flip it, whatever it is. I don't know what the default would be on a Windows 10 install, whether it be turned on or not. Hardware acceleration, I guess, is what they call it. And the reason they did hardware acceleration is, it's kind of a workaround. In the old days, slower computers, they couldn't display video very well. So they would basically just blast it onto the screen. They'd bypass the graphics drivers and bypass the graphics card and just put the bits up on the screen. That was called hardware acceleration. And it may be, in fact, in a modern computer that it's turned on and doesn't need to be, or vice versa. So it's a little tricky to get to because it's not in the regular control panel. You have to get into, probably the easiest way, the way I get in is you right-click on the desktop and you'll see Personalize. And then once you're in Personalize, you can select Display. And then from there, change Display Settings. And from there, Advanced Settings. Don't you love how they bury this stuff? And then once you're in Advanced Settings, now you're in the Graphics Property box. And there's a Troubleshooting tab. And then once you're in the Troubleshooting tab, you click Change Settings. How many clicks are we deep now? 8, 9? In Change Settings, you'll see the Display Adapter Troubleshooter. And there will be a slider that says Hardware Acceleration, and you can play with that.
Okay.
There's also, I guess you could go into the registry directly and disable it entirely. But it may not fix this, but it might be a way to diagnose the problem. So change the setting, see if that does it. Is it when you're doing this, is it always the same browser? Is it different browsers or one browser?
I've only been using Chrome, so I honestly haven't tried it.
So that's another. So the reason I keep asking you, like, well, have you tried this? The best way to figure out what's causing, here's the problem. We don't know what's causing this. So what we have to do is try stuff until we figure out. And what we're doing when we're trying stuff is we're trying to find the cause by troubleshooting, by eliminating possibilities. So the first thing, you do the easiest thing. The first thing I would check, as I mentioned, is trying some other video source. See if it happens there. The next thing I would check is try a different browser. What if it's Chrome? What if Chrome has a problem? And as you're watching video, Chrome starts to eat memory, and pretty soon, this is what it sounds like, by the way. Something is eating up memory, and it gets to the point where you have no free memory, and the system just chokes. So that'd be another thing to try is you have on Windows 10 three browsers. I know you have Chrome, but you also have Internet Explorer and Edge. Try it on Edge.
Okay.
And see if YouTube slows down on Edge.
Would you would you recommend doing a fresh install of Windows 10?
Maybe, maybe not. It may be that you just need to do a fresh install of the video drivers. But again, it's until we figure out what's wrong. If it's the browser, it's not the video drivers. But it's, maybe that would be another thing to try, is reinstall the video drivers. The other possible cause is heat. Watching video can use a lot of cycles and maybe heat up the computer. Although there are other things you're doing. Browsing heats up the computer pretty good too, especially if you scroll a lot.
Sure.
So there could be, you know, other things involved. There could be the, you know, the codec, codec that YouTube uses has a bug in it, and replacing that would fix it. I think it uses, I'm not sure what it uses, VP6, I'm not sure, but it doesn't use Flash anymore. So in other words, it's computers are such a complex system. It's really hard to figure out, you know, you've got a symptom. Now what we want to do is try different things until the symptom changes or goes away. And whatever, you know, affects the symptom will be give you some clue as to what's causing it. It could be so many different things. It's hard for me to say, we'll do this, do that. But here's some things to try.
Okay.
All right.
All
right. And I think in Chrome, there is also a setting. Somebody in the chat room, Twisted Mister, says there's a use hardware acceleration when available setting in Chrome. You want to turn that off. And you can get into the advanced Chrome settings. You can get into, there's no easy way to get into them. You have to do about colon Chrome in the Chrome browser. Is that right? No, that'll just give you the regular settings. I'm not sure how you get the advanced settings in Chrome. But there are deep within it, secret, super secret, weird settings that you can get to. Anybody in the chat room remember? It's not about, I thought it would be about Chrome. It is in Firefox, about Firefox, I think, right? About colon Firefox.
Isn't it at the bottom of the settings page?
You know, I don't mean the advanced, is it at the bottom of the settings page? I don't mean the like advanced settings. I mean like the super secret settings page. You know what I'm talking about? The super secret, not advanced, but like the stuff, yeah. Chrome colon, is this going to work? /// settings, which gives you the regular settings, /system. So if you're on the Chrome settings page, add /system to it. Chrome? Wow, is that wild. What we're seeing, I think what really happens nowadays is companies are hiding this stuff, basically. Now, see, well, that's certainly where you can get the hardware acceleration. That's good. Chrome colon /settings/system. You can turn off use hardware acceleration when available. That's a good one. That's a useful one. And then once you're there, you can search settings for other interesting things. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Chrome colon /GPU. Wow. Oh. I know, you know, they put these in here, but they bury them. They hide them because they don't want normal people. Oh, there you go. Now we're in the super secret. Chrome colon /GPU. Wow, look at that stuff. Holy cow. Holy moly. That's an interesting one. Flags, that's the one I was thinking of. Chrome colon /flags. That's the one I was thinking of. That's all the experimental features. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Phone number 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Line 1, Paul, Anaheim Hills, California. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Leo, how are you?
I'm well.
Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure. Thanks for calling.
So, I don't know if you got a chance to see the notes, but I have a 2013 Hyundai Sonata.
Oh, nice.
It's a limited edition, and it has an error on our on the dash. It's actually, when we Googled it, or I Googled it, it actually came up as a Windows, I think, CE.
Yeah, it's actually probably what they call Microsoft Car, which was an operating system based on Windows CE that Microsoft used to sell companies. I know my Ford had, for many years, had Microsoft Car as its operating system. That is happening less often now. I think even maybe Microsoft no longer does it. It's their connected vehicle platform. So did you have a question, or were you just surprised to see it there?
Well, the problem is we can't get rid of it.
Yeah.
And if we want to trade the car in or sell it, you know, it the error.
Yeah, does it operate, or does it, is the error on top of a working screen, or?
Yes, it's on top of a working screen. It doesn't allow the backup camera. It doesn't allow the Bluetooth interface. Nice. As well as navigation.
Yeah. You can't. There's nothing you can fix, in all likelihood. But modern cars with these fancy, entertainment systems, they run on something. They're computers. You got a screen in your car. You probably have a computer behind it. I mean, it may not be a computer as you're used to it. It's funny that you're getting a Windows CE error code, but not surprising because that's obviously what Hyundai used as their operating system. More recently, a BlackBerry-based operating system, well, a BlackBerry-owned operating system called QNX, QNX, is very popular. But what's happened is that the computer, probably the firmware in your car, has been damaged somehow. It's just like any computer. The software's messed up. It's not the kind of thing where you could say, oh, well, if I could just get a boot disk, I could reformat and reinstall. It doesn't. I think you'd have to take it to a Hyundai dealer to get them to fix it.
So we did, and they said it's a $3,000 replacement of just the radio.
Oh, isn't that great? And I don't think it's – well, maybe it is the radio. Maybe it is. But I think probably that's not accurate. You might take it to a different dealer to see what they say.
Okay.
Because probably – well, it's hard to say. You know, it's not unusual these days, and it's unfortunate, for wholesale swapping of non-working pieces. If you bring a computer to Apple, it's not working. They're just as likely to give you a new computer as try to fix it. And if they fix it, they're going to fix big subsystems. I remember – and this is not anything new. I remember breaking on Apple laptop. This must have been 10, 15 years ago, breaking the power connector back before the days of MagSafe. And really, when it breaks the power connector, all that's really done is that the little piece of metal that you connect into, which is attached to the motherboard, this breaks off. The solders break off. I went to Apple. They said, well, the only way we can fix it is to replace the motherboard for $2,000. Brought it to an Apple authorized repair center. And they said, oh, yeah, we'll just resolder it. And for $15, they put the piece back on the motherboard. But that's the trend, and it's for a number of reasons. It's not more economical for the end user, that's for sure. It's probably more profitable. Plus, you don't have to train your technicians quite as much, you know. And the problem is these things, especially nowadays in cars, are so high-tech that, there aren't shade tree mechanics who can reprogram your entertainment system. They can't even tune the car anymore. So we're kind of in this is kind of the modern world, alas. What's wrong with it is probably very simple. But you can't get into it yourself. I don't think there's, you know, maybe that if you wanted to try to repair it yourself, some judicious Googling of that Hyundai model might help. This is why the right to repair movement is such a big deal. I think the last count, something like 22, 23 states are trying to get right to repair legislation passed through because many companies, Apple's one of them, John Deere is the one that's really causing the most trouble. Yeah, John Deere, the tractor maker, they make giant combines and harvesters, big factory farm implements, and the farmers are not really able to repair those anymore. John Deere is so afraid that people will steal the software that they require you to bring it to an authorized center for expensive repairs. If you get somebody to repair it, it won't work until you bring it to the dealer and recertify it. You don't really, in other words, John Deere and Apple and others are treating these devices as something you can't repair. You know, your iPhone, if you get a screen repair on your iPhone, among other things, Apple will disable the fingerprint reader. And Apple says, well, that's because we can't be sure it's secure anymore. But it also has the nice added value of putting third-party repair companies out of business. Apple also doesn't sell parts, and they don't put out the manuals. So these right-to-repair laws, California has one. Many states are working on them. These right-to-repair laws, I think California might have passed its law. I can't remember. But that's one of the things right-to-repair legislation promulgates, supports, is it says companies have to provide repair manuals and parts so third parties can do repairs. But I'd be very surprised if Hyundai has put out repair manuals and parts so that you can fix this yourself. They want you to go to the dealer. Irvine Rob actually has a good idea. He says, look for a reset hole. Who knows? There might be one, right? You know, sometimes on the devices, they have a little pinhole that you can put a paper clip in there and press and hold it. Your router has one. Who knows? Maybe that Hyundai Entertainment System has one. I would do some searching to see if anybody has parts or has solutions. You'd be amazed. I mean, my friends at iFixit, they're a sponsor for a long time, iFixit.com, are really big supporters of the right to repair movement. And they have their whole goal in life is to get parts and manuals to repair everything, not just consumer electronics, although they're very big on that, but even like toys from McDonald's Happy Meals. They have tools for those. And you can read about the right to repair. They're big supporters of that. And you can read about the right to repair and exercise your right to repair on their website. They even have they support a nonprofit site all about the right to repair. You should have the right to repair your Hyundai, right? Not have to buy a whole new head unit. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. We talk about everything. Everything, including how to fix your car. I think that's a first. 8888-ASK-LEO. The website, techguylabs.com. And by the way, if you, maybe you're a Hyundai owner, said, hey, I had that problem and I know exactly how to fix that. If you go to the website, techguylabs.com, there's no sign up, there's no fee. You can leave a comment. We break up the site into shows, episodes. This is episode 1,488. Then each episode into hours, each hour into calls. Find this call and answer if you have a better solution. Love to hear from you. Hour number two of the Tech Guy Show, just around the corner. Our digital camera guy, too, Chris Marquardt. Stay right here. Our show today brought to you by my toothbrush. Actually, I love this toothbrush because, for one thing, I'm a big fan of electric toothbrushes. So much to the point, Lisa and I were talking about this, when we were on a trip, we had a regular old, we didn't know how to brush our teeth anymore. We lost the muscles to do that. We keep extra quips around the house because Michael's friends come over for sleepovers, and they never bring toothbrushes. So we now have a different quip head for all of his friends, and they come and they can brush their teeth. Quip is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association, and it is so cool. For starters, it's a fraction of the cost of other bulkier. They don't do a better job, just more expensive toothbrushes, $25. Plus, they deliver new brush heads on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping. You can also get their toothpaste. They have great toothpaste, but you don't have to. Quip has everything you want, the built-in timer, so that 30 seconds per quadrant. That's really important, so you get your full 2 minutes of brushing. They also, I love the pamphlet that comes with your Quip that tells you how to brush. I learned, it says don't rinse afterwards. What? I didn't know that. You knew that? I didn't know that. So here I am at my advanced age learning how to brush my teeth all over again. Quip also, and this is another reason I love it, it doesn't have a charger. It just uses standard, I think they're AAA batteries. And they go for months. So it's great. It's a great travel brush because it's smaller and lighter. And if you run out of charge, you just put a battery in. And then it has a little adhesive on the holder, and you put it right on the mirror so you don't forget to brush. It's right there. I love that. And it unsticks, too, so you can bring it when you travel. It's a perfect travel toothbrush. And, at $25, if you lose it or you forget it, it's not the end of the world. I really love Quip. Finally, I'm not the only one. I just found out it was on Oprah's O-List. Nice. Time magazine named it one of the best inventions of the year. And as I mentioned, it's the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association, plus backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists, and of course, hundreds of thousands of happy Quip customers, including me. Now, here's the deal. Quip starts at $25, but you got to go to getquip, getquip.com/twit. Use the /twit, that way they know you heard it here, okay? You'll get your first refill pack free if you do that, so you get a benefit too when you purchase any Quip electric toothbrush. So get your first refill pack free at getquip.com/twit, getquip.com/twit, getquip.com/twit. It is a better way to brush. And I'm thankful for their support. And I always use Abby as an example. I don't know. I guess because she's at that age now where she's 26. She's thinking about real life. She said, I'm really tired of brushing my teeth. I said, you need an electric toothbrush. She said, yeah, my dentist said that. I said, don't worry. One will arrive at your door tomorrow. And I got her Quip, and it's going to have the heads and everything. It's just awesome. She loves it. I don't know why. Abby and I have a dental health thing. We found some. She brought me some really good dental floss that she found. And then she said, I said, this is really good. She said, yeah, it wasn't what I was looking for. There's a dental floss subscription service called Coco. And she said, I was trying to get Coco. So I subscribed to dental floss for her too. Quip and Coco. She's set. She's set. Dental health is our greatest wealth. Here comes GDPR. We'll be probably talking a lot more about this in the next couple of weeks. The General Data Protection Regulation passed by the EU, and any company that does business in Europe has to abide by it. And that means there are a lot of companies right now scrambling like crazy because, I mean, if you're a business, chances are you do have customers in the EU. That's why maybe you've noticed new privacy regulations, new rules from Google, Facebook, adding features. One of the key requirements of the General Data Protection Regulation is that you should be able to delete your data from a company. You should be able to say, hey, I don't want Facebook. I don't want you to have any information about me. Please delete it all. And the fines are massive if you don't. Now, in most cases, companies can say, well, we're only going to apply these rules to Europeans because, you know, we don't want to. But Facebook has said, no, we're going to, you know, since we've got to build this in for all of Europe, it's too hard for us to figure out if you're a European or not. So we're just going to make this available to everybody. So in a way, we in the U.S. have some, you know, some thank yous for GDPR. There are problems with GDPR, too. And frankly, I bet you there are a lot of small businesses going, what the heck are we going to do? May 25th is when it goes into effect. Already we're seeing some interesting side effects. There was a company called Unroll Me. Did you ever use Unroll Me? They were kind of a thinly veiled attempt to mine your email. I signed up for it because I liked the idea. It would unsubscribe you from newsletters you'd subscribe to. And if you wanted to, it could make a digest of them instead and give you one email a week or one email a day of the newsletters. Or you just get rid of them all. I thought, oh, that's great, but you have to give it access to your Gmail. Well, of course, because they have to be able to scan it, right? Well, it turns out they were selling that information. In fact, quite famously sold a bunch of it to Uber. Unroll Me said, we can't change our rules. We're just not going to do business. If you're in Europe, you can't use Unroll Me. That's one solution. Another company, maybe you've heard of Clout with a K, K-L-O-U-T. They used to sell information about your social media reach. You know, are you an influencer on Twitter and Facebook and all that? And I don't think they mentioned GDPR, but I think it's because of GDPR because they say we're going out of business May 25th entirely. May 25th. We're shutting our doors. That can't be a coincidence. That's when GDPR becomes law. Fines can be as high as 4% of your revenue. This could be billions for a big company. 4% of your revenue. And some of it's a bit of a burden, I think. If you're a business, I think with 250 or more people, you have to have a full-time data protection officer, a DPO. You have to create a new job, basically, and hire somebody whose job it is to protect the privacy of your users. Now, I think that's great. I'm glad my company isn't that big. Because I don't know if we had to hire a data protection officer, I don't know what we'd do. 80% of people surveyed, IT professionals companies in the U.S., 80% of those said they will be spending at least $100,000 to become compliant. You've got to write new privacy policies, implement new, capabilities. There's even kind of a lot of gray areas. For instance, it's not clear. Almost all websites keep your IP address. They log your IP address. That's, your internet address. And usually those logs are kept for, analyzing problems and so forth. Not to invade your privacy. After all, your IP address doesn't say much about you. At best, it gives some dubiously valuable geographic information about you. But it's not clear, but there are those who say, oh, no, that's personal information, and you have to be able to, you have to tell people you collect it, and you have to give them a way to delete it should they want to. Oy, oy, oy. That could change. If every website in the U.S. would have a problem with that, because you don't know if the people are visiting you from Europe. So grab some popcorn, sit back, and watch what happens. It's happening already. You're starting to get a lot of notices and changes and privacy policy and so forth. And I really wonder how much enforcement there's going to be. I mean, how aggressively the EU is going to enforce this. Because if they do, I can pretty much guarantee you there'll be a lot of companies that are not ready. That come May 25th, they're not going to have done everything they need to do. Fascinating. Fascinating. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number. Let's go to line two now. Devin, Santa Monica. Hi, Devin.
Hi, Leo. Can you hear me?
I can. What can I do for you?
Oh, yes. I need to know about AI technology. I know it's not the Siri, it's the computer program. Is there any way you can elaborate on it a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those buzzwords like our virtual reality that have different meanings depending on who you talk to. And in a lot of cases, when people say AI, which is short for artificial intelligence, they're using it as a marketing term. More and more you're hearing about programs and devices that have AI built in. And that's... I don't think in many cases it's really AI. What I think of as AI, artificial intelligence, is a thinking machine, right? A computer that can act as if it's human. Now, there's general artificial intelligence. That's very hard to do. We're way far off, probably years, if not decades, from that. But we certainly are getting better. I think maybe a preferred phrase would be machine learning. And Google's, of course, the king of machine learning right now. If you think about it, and sometimes they call it artificial intelligence. I'm not sure it really qualifies. But for instance, if you put your photos in Google's Photos application, which is free, you can then search it for pictures of dogs, for instance. Let's say I have 60,000 pictures on Google Photos, and I can type in a search for dogs, and it'll find many of my dog pictures. It won't find all of them, and sometimes there's a cat in there with the dog pictures. But it does that with machine learning. It's trained it on many, many photos. In fact, that's one of the reasons they offer this for free. So
Siri is not the AI. Siri, when I ask a question for Siri, I tell Siri to translate that in Italian.
Yeah, it's sort of like AI. Siri, it acts like AI. It sort of feels like there's somebody there you're talking to. But really, I guess in my mind, and I, you know, I've done a lot of computer programming, and I kind of understand how computer programming works. In my mind, if you could write a simple computer program to produce the same results, that's not artificial intelligence. To me, artificial intelligence requires machine learning. In some cases, artificial intelligence is supported by computers learning from themselves. For instance, Google has a Go playing, the Asian chess-like game called Go, has a Go playing computer that actually bested the world's champion of Go last year. And the way it learned how to play, it wasn't taught by humans. It learned to play by playing millions of Go games a second against itself. And as a result, it plays Go. Now, that's artificial intelligence. That's a computer playing a game, having taught itself how to play. All it was provided with was the rules. That's different from Deep Blue, the computer that won the world chess, you know, beat the world chess championship about a decade ago, because it was taught how to play. It was given positions. Sure. In fact, some say it was cheating because it was taught how to beat the world champion, specifically Garry Kasparov. It said, now this is what you do to beat Kasparov. But the Go computer didn't do that. It taught itself how to play. That's artificial intelligence. I would say Siri is not artificial intelligence. It benefits in the voice recognition. It benefits from a lot of machine learning. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
What would be in the future? You know, the Google founder, what's his name, Sergio, said that there are downside to the AI technology as well.
Well,
dark side of AI technology.
Yeah.
Well, what are we expecting from let's say in 5-10 years? Are we going to be getting devices with AI in it? Will there be more automation in the grocery store? Will there be more automation everywhere? You know, like everything would be handled by computers.
I think so. I think so. I don't know what the time frame is. You know, a lot of what we think of as AI comes from science fiction movies. You know, think about HAL 9000 in the movie 2001, right? Here was a computer that you could talk to. It had a personality. In fact, it was a little bit paranoid, and at one point it locked Dave, the astronaut, out of the ship. I'm sorry, Dave. I can't do that. That's what we think of as artificial intelligence. That's general artificial intelligence. That is a long way off. That is decades off. But then there is domain-specific artificial intelligence that we already have. And so the Go-playing computer, that's a perfect example of a domain-specific artificial intelligence, and I think it qualifies as artificial intelligence. We're getting close, though. And I talked yesterday, I played some clips from this thing Google's been working on called Google Duplex, which takes the Google Assistant and has it call humans on your behalf. So you could ask, and you could do it with Siri if Apple were, but the problem is Apple's not anywhere near as advanced, I think, in this as Google. Google's the real leader here, at least in the U.S., although I'm hearing that China has plowed a lot of government money into artificial intelligence research. They're in all likelihood way ahead of us. But we don't really know, do we? Because they're kind of a closed system. But Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Google, demonstrated this on Tuesday by saying, all right, okay, you know who, Goog, make me a hair appointment for Sunday at 7. And the assistant, sounding like a human, I might add, very much like a human, with uhs and ums and kind of upendings, they up-talked, called a real beauty salon and made an appointment and did it perfectly. And here's the thing that's really interesting. As far as I could tell, indistinguishably from a human. So the human at the beauty salon had no idea it was talking to a computer. No idea. And Sundar Pichai said, we have thousands of these calls. This Google Duplex technology will most likely make it to your phone, your Google phone, and actually your iPhone too, if you use the Google Assistant on the iPhone, in the next, they say this year, well, we'll see, soon. This year, next year, in the near-term time frame. That's I guess you could say that's artificial intelligence. It's indistinguishable from a human. That's pretty close to the science fiction definition of artificial intelligence. But remember, they're not thinking. They're not thinking. It's just a computer program, but a computer program that's been trained against a lot of voices, a lot of situations, that starts becoming artificial intelligence. I think we could talk more about AI. There's so much to talk about. I'd love to hear what you think, your examples of AI working and not working. 8888 Ask Leo. Did you hear Duplex?
It sounded awesome.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't know that it wasn't.
You wouldn't know.
You think they're going to call for tech help? Duplex is going to call the tech help?
Well, no, Google's not just letting anybody do this, right? You have to go through the assistant, and it has certain things it does. So it isn't yet like in the wild, and it won't be. I think Google's going to try to keep it from getting in the wild. But it will at some point. In the next, even more to the point, how long before you and I are replaced by it? I know. I know. But it wouldn't be so hard to make
a fake Leo.
Certainly a fake DJ is easy, but a fake Leo even, like a talk show host.
I worked at a radio station 30 years ago.
Oh, most of them are automated. Yeah, that's easy. But that's pre-recorded. So that's a good example. In fact, I'm going to use that because that's a good example. A lot that might be billed as AI in this modern age because it's such a good marketing term, but it's not. That's not AI.
I don't know if you said this or if somebody else said it, but it makes it really clear for me. You did say it's all code.
It's just code.
It's all code. So it's when the machine.
If then then
own code.
That's what makes it AI. So there's two things in my opinion, and it's just my opinion, that make it AI or as opposed to just code.
Algorithms.
Computer algorithms. If you do this, then you do that. Can be very sophisticated, and Siri really kind of is that. But when you're training it against real world stuff, so the voice recognition that's trained against real world voices, and then it learns from that, and it continues to learn,
algorithms.
And if it can in effect program itself,
yeah.
Like then it's AI.
I mean, that's what the Go example is.
Yeah, if it can teach itself.
So Bert came up with the phrase. Have you seen the twit? You know what twit this is?
What?
Twit of the Beast.
1480. Oh, 666. Yeah, the twit of the Beast. I might have to call it that. That might be the title. The Twit of the Beast. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. We're trying to think of a a way to describe AI. And I think that probably the best way to do it is to, and it requires a little bit of an understanding of how computers work. Computers are really machines. They're deterministic machines. You tell them what to do and they do it. And all the computer programs, almost all the computer programs we've used, you've used over the years, are just that. They're a list of instructions. Now, because computers are fast and you can have many, many instructions, millions of lines of code, they can look like they're pretty sophisticated. But ultimately, for the most part, most of the time when you use technology, it's following a path that was written out for it by a computer programmer or many computer programmers. They're complex. They can simulate thought, but they're not thinking. When you take the leap is when a computer either is modifying its own code, writing its own program, learning its own stuff and changing what it does based on that, then maybe that – I think that qualifies as AI. So when you ask, is Siri AI? Well, parts of it are. For instance, the voice recognition, I think it depends heavily on machine learning, lots of samples of humans talking to it, and then the programmer saying, okay, well, that's what that means, that's what that means, and the machine kind of learning. It's kind of on the border of AI. But for the most part, the response Siri gives you is not AI. So if you ask Siri, what time is the baseball game start tomorrow? It's going through a series of decisions. It's a decision tree saying, okay, let's look at the words. I hear baseball. I hear time. I hear tomorrow. I think what that means, I should deliver the baseball schedule for tomorrow. That's not AI. That's no thinking involved. It's really a decision tree. It's a lot of if statements, that kind of thing. And most of what you use is, almost all, I would say, of what we do with computers is done that way. We're just starting to get AI in the mix. It's going to take a little while. And it's deucedly hard to do. But I have to say, if anybody's starting to show some real AI chops, it's Google. It really is. Some very impressive stuff being done by Google. And their demonstration of Google Duplex on Tuesday. If you haven't heard it yet, check it out. It's pretty impressive. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Chris Marquardt coming up next. Yeah, I mean, so here's a good question. Is a self-driving car AI? I think it's conventionally considered to be AI.
Does it learn from its mistakes?
No. Everything it does is programmed.
It's not making new algorithms.
It's not making new algorithms. There's machine learning involved, but...
is there a leap of logic?
No, there's never a leap, yeah.
It's always within a framework.
It's always... Right. So, I would say not. I would say it's still pretty much deterministic. You know, you give it, you know, a model of the world around us, and you tell it what to do. When it sees this, do this. When it sees this, do this. I don't think at any point it's a pretty fuzzy definition, but I think it's not making a leap.
It interprets what it sees, but it's not making new rules.
Yeah.
Machine
learning is not a form of AI, Mike. I wouldn't categorize it that way. I would say it's a requisite for AI. But machine learning by itself is not AI. And in fact, it's more proper really to say that a lot of what we're using today benefits from machine learning. But that's not AI. The voice recognition that we use, that has benefited from machine learning, but that's not necessarily AI.
Well, I think the more advanced the automation gets, the more demanding we are. We're saying, well, that's not AI.
Right.
I mean, 10 years ago, could you imagine we would have felt that it was?
We went through something called the AI winter, where people who had very high hopes for AI, including most of the best minds in AI, gave up. They said, we can't do it. And I think really what they recognized is, you know, you can train a computer with patterns.
A recipe.
But it's still, in my opinion, if it's a recipe, it's not AI. If a human has to write a recipe, it's not AI. It becomes AI when the computer can write its own recipes. There are very few places where that's happening.
Where it can create a recipe that you didn't know you needed.
Yeah.
So the Waymo car accident is in the town where I work. I'm sorry, the Uber, the death, that's in the town where I work. And the accident that happened, was it 2 weeks ago now? That's in the town I live.
Ah. Is it Tempe?
Tempe is where Chandler.
Chandler, yeah.
The Waymo, there was no way that was the car's fault.
Wait. The LiDAR should have seen her.
No.
It was turned off.
I agree.
Okay.
The Waymo car came and hit it head on. But yeah, no, that one.
Yeah, the Uber was Uber's fault, but the Waymo was hit by a car coming out of it. You can't.
As long as there are people driving.
Right. Well, and you know what? Even then, if a self-driving car caused an accident, and then that car that bounced off that car hits your car, there's nothing to self. You can't. It doesn't eliminate that.
Right.
Can't.
I mean, I guess in theory.
Then you'd never have an accident?
I guess that's the theory behind it.
Yeah, you're still going to have accidents.
You know, the police still have to be able to drive a car, right?
Yeah, right. That's a good point. No, they don't have to, do they?
No.
I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. That magic music means it's time for Photo Guy himself. Superman of photos, Chris Marquardt, joins us every week to talk about getting better pictures. Last week we talked about camera phones, which I think almost everybody listening probably has a camera in their phone of some kind or other. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Leo. Now, last time we talked a bit about tech and apps and camera phones. This time, I want to bring this back to, let's say, the creative side of things.
Okay.
The side that doesn't really matter what phone or what camera you use, and you can think about these things with any camera you like. And this is about space in photos and spacing in photos. Now, in general, I think it's important when you point your camera somewhere and you shoot, there should be one step in between, and that's the think step. You know, point, think, and shoot.
Point,
make things
think,
a bit
shoot.
More conscious, right? Make them a bit more conscious. Try to think about what you're doing there. And of course, one thing that's kind of on the top is have a subject in your photo. Kind of make it clear what the photo is about. Which you can do by getting closer to things or eliminating stuff out of the photo. So composing it in a way that you don't have distractions in there, that it's clear what it's about. But then the next step is, how do you space that thing in the photo? Where do you put it in the photo? And especially, how does that thing relate to the rest of the photo in terms of spacing? And a very simple way to think about this is, if you look at a photo, well, our photos are typically rectangular. So you have that frame made out of four borders, and you have that subject in your photo. And now those, of course, have a distance from each other. That person in your photo, let's say, has a distance to the frame, to the left, to the right, to the top, to the bottom. And you can space that in different ways. You can place that anywhere in that frame. But there will be some placements of that person that will be kind of weird. For example, if you squeeze that person all the way into a corner.
I like that.
I do like that too, but it gives it a certain feeling. Like,
right.
Just imagine.
Cramped.
Imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah, like crammed, doesn't have space to breathe, right? It doesn't have any room around it. So I like giving things a bit of space in the frame so they can stretch out to the sides a bit. Now, of course, put that person somewhere away from the sides of the frame. But then the question is, how do these different distances relate to each other? Like, you have, let's say, a portrait. Yeah, you have a space above that person that goes to the edge of the frame, and then on the side of the person, left and right. Are these spaces the same? Are they uneven? Are they even? Are they balanced? Are they not balanced? I'm not saying one is better than the other, but the moment you change that balance towards one side, you are changing how that picture feels. If you have lots of very evenly balanced space in the picture, like imagine a portrait photo, not just a portrait of a person, but the camera in portrait orientation. So the frame is upright. And you put that head in the top and you have the same space towards the top, the left, and the right. That'll make this a very, let's say, an offensive picture, right? It's not going to irk you to look at it, and because there's like a very evenly distributed space. But then imagine you move them all the way to the side. Now you have the same space on the top and on the side maybe, but not on the other side. And then that gives it a bit more of tension, a bit more of an uneasy feeling maybe. And if that's what you want in the frame, hey, that's one of the ways to do it. But you don't have to. You can balance things out and make it kind of a more pleasing photo to look at. And depending on what you want to show, this is one way to do it.
It's funny how the use of space can really affect how you feel about a photograph. I'd never really thought about that.
Now, space doesn't only go between that subject and other part and the edges of the frame, but just imagine you have several things in the frame. Let's say you take, let's say, a group shot, for example. You have a group of people. And how do you manage that space between those people? Imagine you have a few people that don't really know each other well. How would they normally kind of they wouldn't like snuggle up to each other? They would be a bit of a safety distance between them normally.
There might be some space in between them.
A bit of a space there,
yeah.
And the moment you have space between them, that tells something. It's not a group anymore; it's individuals, but. How do you do that? How do you remove that space between these people without making them snuggle up? Yeah, well, you can layer them. You can have a couple of people in the front, a couple in the back, and overlap, just visually overlap them. That's taking that space away as well. And then you end up with a group that looks like a group because they overlap and they kind of belong together space-wise. So now all those individual pieces of that group, those individual persons, have turned into one entity, which is now a group. So you made another subject, but now the subject is not the individuals, but it's the entire group by just overlapping them. Hmm. And now you can go back a step to what I started off with. Now, how do you place that group in the frame? How is the spacing between that group and the edges and the top and the bottom? So you can see how you can apply this in like on a all the way down, pretty much. That spacing is pretty much consideration every shot I do. I look what's important, how does it relate to other things. You can even space things out. If you want to get this separate feeling between things, you can space them out and then continue that space towards the edge. Let's say you have stuff in the frame that is repetitive. It doesn't have to be people. It could be, I don't know, pillars in a park or something, and you space those out in the photo. And then what do you do with the space between the outermost pillar and the edge? Do you make that the same space that's between the other pillars, or do you open that up, or you do close that a bit? So just in general, a little bit of thinking about space in a picture can go a very, very long way.
This how do you, is so how do great. You do I love that? It. How do I
is
do
that,
it?
Is that something you think about?
Not
when
in the
you,
least.
When you shoot
it? You know, it's funny. My sister is a painter, and she's got a Master of Fine Arts from Columbia University in New York. And one of the things painters talk about all the time, they use the word negative space, which True. Is what's not the subject. She's always talking about negative space and how important it is. I always thought of it in terms of part of painting, but of course, isn't photography in a way?
It's exact
painting?
Same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's even the same if you're an architect. How do you space those windows on that front of the house?
Sure.
Are those windows close to the edge? Are they more in the middle? Are they evenly spaced? It's all the same thing. It's just applying the same principles to different fields.
I guess, and this isn't the right way to do it, but I'm an instinctive photographer. I don't have in the front of my mind what I'm looking at. I just look for something I like. And sometimes that does mean that I'm using the space as much as I am the subject matter, or the space between the subjects and that kind of thing. But I think that's why this is valuable, is to take it from the back of mind, something I'm not conscious of, and understanding it better so I can know why I like a picture and maybe
now
aim
of,
at
of
that.
Of course, if you start doing that, it'll slow you down initially.
It does.
Right?
Initially, you start thinking about it, right.
But then if you do it over and over and over again, you'll automate that. You won't even think about it consciously anymore. And that's when things start changing.
Here's an opportunity to practice space. Our photo assignment, it's foot. Take a picture illustrating the word or concept foot. Maybe throw a little space in there. I don't know how you might do that. But think about it and then upload it to Flickr. That's our photo sharing site. It's free from Yahoo. And then we have a special group there, the Tech Guy group. Renee Silverman, the moderator. You can, if you're not already a member, join that group and upload as many as one per week. In the next couple of weeks, maybe not next week, maybe the week after, we'll pick three. Chris will pick three and review them on the air. You can find Chris at discoverthetopfloor.com and, around about this time every week on the radio show. Chris, great to talk to you. We'll talk again next week.
Absolutely.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. That's artificial intelligence. So interesting question in the chat room. Would you say an ant is intelligent or art has artificial intelligence?
Not artificial.
Real intelligence?
To a degree.
Does it? No, I wouldn't say reflex is intelligence. Yeah.
But
reflex is programming.
They have to think whether or not something's edible. They have to think about making their colony. Now, some of that is definitely.
This is why it's so hard to define. I don't know. I mean, if we had a computer that was as smart as an ant, I would say that's. No.
Certainly,
you could. A dog is intelligent because a dog can have different responses to the same stimuli.
Emotion.
Yeah.
It's quite a lot of emotional overlay.
So
yeah.
A computer will never feel emotion. So
it has to simulate it, right? Yeah. But you can simulate emotion. That's not hard.
Empathy. Simulate that.
It's
all part of the window dressing, though, isn't it? So that we'll accept.
So Mike B. says intelligence is the ability to acquire and apply knowledge and skills. See, and that coincides with our definition of artificial intelligence, which is unless the computer can acquire skills on its own, it's not AI.
I think there needs to be some creativity and a leap of some sort that you can't
eat. Well, that creativity is a whole separate kettle of fish. I mean, I don't think you'll ever be able to say a computer is truly creative. It might look creative. It will look creative. And say, that's what Kurzweil always says, is if you can't tell the difference, what does it matter? Right?
It has to be able to do it on more than one subject.
Because otherwise
it's just programming again.
Right.
Missing a piece of the puzzle, and if we get that in there,
maybe.
Maybe there's some biochemistry that needs to be added. It's easy if you say it quick.
And as impressive as that Google presentation was, they may have programmed every possibility they could think of into it.
Right. I think the use of the word reflex was good. Because that's what reflex is an automatic response, you know, based on programming. So reflex is not intelligence. Does the ant problem solve? If the ant problem solves, problem solving is intelligence. But. I mean real problem solving. I don't mean solving a quadratic equation, because that can be done formulaically. A computer can do that, but that's not artificial intelligence.
So is walking around a puddle of water so you don't drown, is that problem solving?
God, this is why it's very difficult. It's very difficult. It's a fascinating conversation. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888, Ask Leo. Back to the phones we go. And on line three, I think, yes, Scott in Arlington, Texas. Hi, Scott.
Hey there, Leo. How are you today?
I am well. How are you?
Doing good. I've got a question about SMS texting programming for you. For a PC.
Okay.
Since you brought up GDPR, I'd like to make a couple of comments about that.
Yeah, I'd love to hear them. All right.
I'm an independent author, and this is going to impact a lot of the authors I know heavily.
Oh, really? How so?
Well, they've got to build, you know, little bitty one-man operations. They've got to build the technology to do it, become a data, whatever you called it, a data protection officer and stuff like that.
Well, the good news is the burden for an individual is smaller than the burden for a company. You have to have a certain number of employees to be required to have a data protection officer and things like that.
Okay.
And if you, in most cases, the things that the activities that you do, for instance, taking a credit card, letting customers buy a book, the company that does your payments is going to have to be GDPR compliant because they have personal information.
Yeah. Well, the main purpose is our mailing list.
Yeah.
Email list.
So if you collect names for a mailing list, that absolutely you're subject to GDPR. But the requirements are not too onerous. You don't have to have a data protection officer unless you have 250 employees. You do have to give anybody the right to remove themselves from the list, but I bet you already do that.
Yes. Well, I use MailChimp, and that's built into it.
And again, I would guess that MailChimp would probably do a lot of the GDPR things for you.
Yeah, that's expected, but most of us also do it from our own website.
If you have a website, you have definitely some requirements. Yep.
Yeah. And so, you know, people are trying to write these opt-in messages into, you know, their email sign-up list, and it's proving very difficult.
Yeah.
One of the things that's come out of this so far is two companies
I think one of them was Volkswagen, and maybe the other was Ford or something like that, sent email signups based on GDPR to thousands of recipients and got fined under existing pre-existing legislation for sending unsolicited emails. And they got pretty heavy fines. So, you know, it's really, there's a catch-22 built into it. And they're really having some issues with it. And it's pretty doggone intimidating to people like me. You know, I think I've sold one book in Europe and two in Australia. And so it's not much of an impact on me, but many authors are really, really worried about it. And it, you know, they see the possibility of it putting them out of business in Europe.
Well, you know, I think they're not alone. I think every small business person is scratching his or her head, wondering what do I have to do and what are the requirements? And, you know, it's not completely clear, to be honest. I guess we're just going to have to wait. Now, I don't think the EU is going to come after every website in the world. That would be an onerous burden. They're going to
be a little onerous on their...
Yeah. They're going to go after Google and Facebook and the big companies first. So I think we'll have a little time to figure this out.
You know, there are always the, you know, rogue authors who find a little shortcut in the system and, you know, break the law. And
well, that's right. And then, in a way, I'm not...
And, you know, and they're going to be targeted.
Yeah.
In the targeting, it usually sweeps up a lot of you know, well-intentioned above board offers.
Right, right.
And so that's an issue. But my main question, I want a program where I can do SMS texting from my PC to, you know, family and friends, so I don't have to switch from my computer to my phone and
right.
so on and so forth. But the main issue I want to avoid is them having to download an app specific for
right.
me to text them to.
So SMS, if you say SMS, that is a service provided by a cell carrier. It's not even using data. It's using its own, you know, expensive data service.
Management.
Yeah.
Technology.
So the way most carriers handle this is they allow you to email SMS messages.
Uh-huh.
You can send an SMS message from any email account. Now, you have to know a couple of things. Of course, the recipient's phone number, but also, and often this is something you may not know, the recipient's carrier, because the email gateway, the SMS gateway to email, usually involves creating an email address that is the phone number at and then whatever special address. For instance, okay. if it's AT&T, it would be at mms.att.net. So you can do this from your desktop. It's pretty ungainly. You can't receive messages back, by the way. So it's a one-way portal. And you do it because they have this gateway, but you need to know, you need to ask your recipients, well, what carrier? Who do you use? You use T-Mobile? Well, that would be then tmomail.net. do you use Verizon? Oh, well, that would be at vtext.com. I mean, it's different for every carrier. So it gets very complicated. Mm-hmm. This is why, by the way, Google's trying to solve this with very limited success. The phone companies make money on SMS. In fact, now that's changing because most of the time now when you buy a plan, you get unlimited text messaging. But still, enough people pay sometimes as much as 20 cents a message that the phone companies don't want to give up this cash cow. If you use WhatsApp or some sort of data-based messaging system, they make no money. It just comes. I mean, they make money, I guess, because you're using data, but they don't make the same kind of money. So they're moving slowly. Google is supporting something called Rich Communication Systems, or RC, or services, I guess, RCS. And their new Android Messenger that comes with the Android phone supports RCS. And they're hoping that they can convince the phone companies to go along. If that happens, that may go a long way to solving this problem. You probably will be able to get a desktop client, for instance. You know, if you use WhatsApp or a Facebook Messenger. You can do it on the desktop. You can send messages.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of us
I never uses anything special. I just use the native app.
Yeah. If you're on an iPhone, Apple kind of solved this, because on an iPhone, when you use messages on an iPhone, it uses SMS as a last resort. It only will SMS to somebody who's not using an iPhone. For everybody else, it uses data, and that's why you can use messages on a Mac on the desktop. So if you were on an Apple computer, you could do that with iPhones. And you can even message people. I think you can SMS people from Apple's messages on the desktop, even if they don't have an iPhone. I think that still works. It will use some – I don't know what Apple's doing, some sort of Apple-provided gateway. I use Google Hangouts. And that does allow me to use a Hangouts plugin in Google Chrome, so I can use desktop to send messages to anybody. And because I use Google Fi voice cell phone system, I can use that as an SMS. But there's not a lot of solutions like this. I mean, it's not a good situation right now. Your best at this point, you can do outbound messaging via mail. I don't know of any. I mean, AT&T, in theory, could have a desktop application, T-Mobile, you know, whoever your carrier is. Let's say and Apple does do this. If I have a phone from T-Mobile could make it so that I have a Windows app that uses my phone to send text messages. To my knowledge, they don't, but they could. It's my guess that they still make enough money on SMS. At one point, I did some math. I think it was $1,400 a megabyte to send SMS messages. It's ridiculously expensive, so ridiculously profitable for the phone company. So I think that they're very slow to move to a solution. My best solution used to be use Facebook Messenger, because pretty much everybody's on Facebook, right? Except that broke. I quit Facebook, and a lot of my friends have quit Facebook, and so that isn't anymore the universal messenger. I would love to hear a solution. If anybody knows it, give me a ring. 8888-ASK-LEO. I would love to solve this one. Let's take a break. We got news at the top of the hour, and I want to take another hour's worth of calls with all of you. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. You also can go to the website, techguylabs.com. Leave comments there. That's free. There's no sign-up. techguylabs.com, and everything we talk about, answers to the questions, relevant links, even more material than I even mention on the radio is up there. techguylabs.com. That's free. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Happy Mother's Day. Our show today brought to you by LastPass. I'm brought to you by LastPass. Every day I use LastPass. In fact, it's the first app I install when I get a new phone or a new computer. I install Chrome, and then I install LastPass in the browser. Although LastPass has extensions for all the browsers, including Microsoft's Edge, Firefox, Safari. LastPass is awesome. What is it? Oh, I should probably tell you what it is. It's a password vault. A password manager is a better name for it. There are just too many passwords to remember these days, whether it's keeping track of your apps on your phone or your websites. Most people, the way they solve it is the wrong way, which is they use the same password over and over again, or some variation of it. I bet you do this, right? Your kid's birthday and the dog's name, and mix stuff together like that, and then you change it slightly. The problem is those passwords are not secure. They're easily guessed. And when you reuse passwords, if one site has a password breach, then you have to know it and change it on every other site. It's just a nightmare. LastPass solves this problem. It automatically remembers and fills in your passwords anytime, anywhere, on your computer, on a mobile device. Better yet, it generates long, strong, random, truly good passwords for you automatically. So you can, from now on, you don't have to make up a password. You just use a generated password from LastPass, and it'll keep track of it. It's so secure, AES 256-bit encryption, it's so secure that I put my passports images in there, because that way I have them when I'm traveling. I put driver's license. I even put my social security numbers and that of all my family members in my LastPass vault. I don't even care if you know that, because I know it's safe. It's encrypted. Only I have access to it. Now, that's the one password you have to remember, is that LastPass password, but I have a really long, I have memorized it password, and that protects everything. It is so great. LastPass. In fact, it's so good, we use it here at the company. We use LastPass Enterprise so that our employees, when we give them access to bank accounts, websites, you know, really important business stuff, they keep it in LastPass. And we make sure those passwords are long, strong, turn on two-factor authentication. That protects my business. LastPass is so great. We've been using LastPass. I've been using it personally for years, LastPass Enterprise at this business, ever since one of our employees put all his websites, all his passwords up on the website so he wouldn't be able to access them easily. That was not a good idea. Ever since, we've been using LastPass Enterprise. In fact, we believe in it so much, it's a benefit if you work for Twit, if you work for my company. Everybody who works for my company gets a free LastPass account. That's part of the deal because I feel better if they use it. It's good for us all. Do you know that 81% of all breaches are caused by weak passwords? LastPass protects every password in our business. It doesn't slow down employees, but it keeps my data safe. There's LastPass products for every possible use. I mentioned we use LastPass Enterprise, but there's also for personal use, LastPass Premium. Actually, my personal account is LastPass Families. I love that because I can share passwords with family members. Plus, emergency access means I can give Lisa access to my LastPass account. She doesn't have it now, but if anything happens to me, she can request it. LastPass sends me an email saying, Lisa wants access to your accounts. Are you still alive? And I've said it, so if I don't respond in 3 days, give Lisa the password. Now, I'm joking around, but that's great peace of mind. I know so many stories about people who passed away, often young, right? Didn't expect to. And people can't get into their bank accounts, can't get into any of their accounts, can't settle the estate because no one has access to it. Another great reason to use LastPass. LastPass Teams for teams of 50 or less at work, at home. Fix your password woes with LastPass, the number one most preferred password program. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit today. lastpass.com/twit. I use it. I'm a firm believer. Steve Gibson. Remember this? This was a few years ago. Interviewed Joe Segrist, the creator of LastPass. Joe showed him all the code, showed him how everything worked, and Steve gave it his thumbs up and then started using it. That's a pretty good endorsement. LastPass.com/twit. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk about tech, computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches. 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number, 888-827-5536. We've been talking about what is artificial intelligence? It's a difficult question. What is, you know, how do you define intelligence in general? Is an ant intelligent? I don't know. It's clear that computers are doing more and more. And more importantly, maybe really, they're more and more ubiquitous. They're moving to the edge. Sometimes people say that. They're going from being a thing on your desktop to a thing that's in everything you use. So, you know, I have an oven that's connected to the internet. Is it artificially intelligent? No, of course not. But the fact that I can control the oven remotely, that it has pre-programmed, it has a camera in it, it can recognize toast and say, I see toast, do you want me to make toast? Is that artificially intelligent? No, but it's pretty good. Does it matter how you categorize it? I guess in a way, I mean, that the recognizing the food that you put in there and then offering a recipe to cook that food, that's kind of close. It's kind of close. It'd be better if it learned new foods. But it can't. A programmer has to add the new foods. 8888 Ask Leo. But I don't know. What do you think? What is artificial intelligence? And do you have an example of real artificial intelligence that we use every day? I don't think voice assistants are it. In fact, if you use them, you pretty much realize this is intelligence, no, I don't want it. What? But maybe there are things you use. Do you drive, I have a Tesla. It drives itself, sort of. It knows when to slow down when it gets close to the car in front. I can actually change lanes automatically. I put the turn signal on. The car has cameras. It looks to see if there's anything in the lane I'm moving into, and then it will move me into that lane without my intervention. Is that, do you have a car that parks itself? A lot of people have that parking system, self-parking system. Is that artificial intelligence? A lot of teenagers think parallel parking is impossible. Your car is better than a teenager in that respect. 8888, Ask Leo. Steve's on the line from Mission Viejo, California. Hi, Steve. You're next.
Hey, Leo. Thanks for taking my call. I've always wanted to say this. Long-time caller, first-time listener.
Yay! Except you got it backwards, but okay.
Well, I know I got it backwards.
You've been on hold a long time, so I guess you are a long-time caller.
Yeah.
That qualifies.
Anyway, you just had a caller, and I got a comment on a caller who was trying to do a texting from his desktop.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know Verizon has an app.
Oh, good.
You can download that will let you text from your desktop, and it will go anywhere.
There you go. There you go. That's what I was speculating, is that a carrier could do this. So I'm glad to hear Verizon does.
Yeah, and I'm sure the other major ones also.
Well, I'm not sure about that, because I'm a T-Mobile and a AT&T customer. I've never heard about any of those. So.
Well, I had to go searching to find the one for Verizon. I'm a Verizon customer. I had to go searching to find it.
Oh, that's it. Maybe that's their solution, is that they don't publicize it. they don't let anybody know. So Verizon's solution is called Message Plus. And there is a desktop app. Wow. Yeah. Wow, that's awesome.
And it's very nice. If you are using an Android device, it will sync up your contacts and the messages between the two.
Very nice. That boy, you know, that's that might be enough reason to change to Verizon. I have to think this will be solved soon, but So that's okay. So that's a question for the rest of you. Does any other carrier do this?
Yeah, I've been using the Verizon app probably for 4 years now, 5 years.
Wow, that's awesome.
Oh, it's out there.
Yeah. Just looking to see if T-Mobile has anything that'll do this. I'd love to find something for... The problem is, of course, you have to have the one that's your carrier specific. So do you tell the Message Plus your Verizon phone number? You must. You log into your Verizon account, right?
Yeah. No, you just tell it the phone number you want to sync up to, and it has to be a Verizon number.
Okay. Well, great. I appreciate that. Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
Have a great one. Take care. On to line three, Justin in Missoula, Montana. Hello, Justin. You've got more additional information about text messaging from the desktop.
Oh, hello, Leo. Pardon me if I misheard you, but you had said to one of the previous callers that if you email to a text message, you know, for example, 555 at VZW, whatever it is.
Yep.
After that person gets the email, they can then text to the email at address that they just got, you know, received something from, and have a full communication with that.
Oh, so it does accept incoming messages. Okay.
Yeah. And
nice
to
know.
You can text to any email address. I'll often send myself, like, notes at work or something.
Oh, that makes sense. Of course. It's a gateway. It goes both directions. Yeah, that makes sense. I apologize. I got it wrong.
No,
thanks for the correction. There are... appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
There are applications like Push Bullet. Is that still around? That will, in effect, connect to your phone from the desktop and then use your phone's capabilities. So Push Bullet, if it's still around, I'm not sure it is. You'd install it. Oh, yeah. You'd install it at Chrome, Firefox, Opera, or on Windows, and then connect it to your phone via Bluetooth, and it could use, or Wi-Fi even, and it could use your phone's SMS services. So that might be another way to do that. Maybe we have solved this. Maybe it's easier than I thought. Thank you, Justin. Sam, Lady Lake, Florida. Hi, Sam.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for calling. I appreciate it.
I have a problem, a vision problem, working on the computer with a 27-inch monitor. I have to use a handheld magnifier, and I get like 3 inches from the screen.
Yeah. Do you have macular degeneration? Or?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a friend who does exactly the same thing.
And one of the problems is the screen seems to generate a big cloud of dust, and it chokes the heck out of me.
Oh, no.
I tried using a dust mask for a while, and that seemed to work.
Yeah. Most computers have a zoom function built in. So my friend with macular degeneration will zoom in on the screen. He doesn't need a magnifying glass. In fact, he doesn't have to get that close to the computer. He can make. In fact, he zooms it so much on a 27-inch monitor that one letter fills the whole screen. And he is absolutely able to read that way. Now, it's not easy, but he can do it.
I tried that before a couple of years ago, and it didn't work too well.
What, use Windows or a Mac?
Well, I have two. I'm keeping an XP machine going, and I have a Mac.
Okay.
Also, both 27-inch monitors.
Apple used to have, and I think they've disabled this. I used to use it all the time.
Well, there's an app on the top edge. There's two-letter A's. One enlarges the text, and one makes it smaller. And I can do that. It helps.
Yeah, but But what you really want is something like a screen magnifier. Basically, it's a digital magnifying glass on the screen. And I know Apple has that. Windows, I remember, has something I think called, is it Quick Zoom? So if you want to do that in Windows. Mm-hmm. They have a magnifier tool. Control-Alt-L brings up the magnification tool. Oh. And then you can move it around with the arrow keys and or the mouse. Mm-hmm. And it's like you're doing what you were talking about, which is putting a magnifying glass over the screen, except it's doing it on the screen, and it can make it as big as you want. Mm-hmm. So Vista has the magnifier tool. I'm pretty sure Windows 10 and Windows 7 do. I'm sure XP must.
Okay.
And then Apple, I don't know what Apple has changed the zooming feature, because Apple used to have a really great zoom feature. I would just hit a couple of keys, and mm-hmm. then I could scroll in with my mouse and make it as big as I wanted, which was, let me see if I can find Apple Zoom. Application zoom pane. Yeah, so you go into the, and always these are called accessibility features. It makes the computer more accessible for people with different disabilities. So the accessibility system preferences has a zoom pane. So you go into the system preferences on your Macintosh, click accessibility, and then zoom, and there are shortcut keys. You can zoom in and out. To zoom in, for instance, Command Option equal sign. Mm-hmm. If I can do it without turning it on, Command Option equal sign. And now you have to turn it on. And then you can also use a scroll wheel on the mouse to pan in and out. So there are ways to do this that would be a lot easier than you getting real close to the screen with a magnifying glass. You won't have to breathe a lot of dust either.
About 3 or 4 years ago, there was an outfit that sold a. It was like wearing a pair of big sunglasses and had LED screens in it.
Oh, how funny.
And it would magnify anything up 6 or 8 times, something
wow.
like that. And it was,
wow.
It would work, but the price tag was out of sight.
Yeah.
Like $15,000.
Well, I think you should, the best way to do this, let the computer do it. It knows what's on the screen. It can make it as big as you want. And that way, other people can continue to use the computer. You can zoom in on the part of the computer you want to see. I think this is a pretty good solution. And I'm sorry you have macular degeneration. That's just a real pain. Real pain.
Yes.
But the nice thing is, unlike a book, at least these computer solutions you can zoom in on.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Yeah, look in the accessibility options on whichever computer you're using, and they almost always have an ability to magnify or zoom in on the screen. They used to be, now somebody in the chat room saying it still does, but I don't, used to be able to press the control button on a Mac and then do the scroll wheel, and it would zoom in or out, but you know, you could zoom in on the screen, but I haven't, that seems to be eliminated. Maybe I have to turn on the accessibility features to get that to work. That's a possibility. Let's see here. Oh, we're moving along. Line 2, Jim, Las Vegas, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Jim.
Leo. Great to chat with you.
Thanks for calling.
For your previous caller, I'm blind, and I never used it, but I've heard of a program called Zoom Text.
Yes. Yeah.
And it was offered by a company that produced a screen reader called Windows Eyes, which no longer exists.
I remember Eyes. Yeah. Yeah.
It was absorbed by a company that produces JAWS, the other right. screen reader, and I believe that is owned by a company called the VFO Group, Victor Frank Oprah.
Guys, you know, though, and it really bothers me, these companies charge an arm and a leg for this stuff.
Yeah, it's true. The screen readers were $900 to $1,000, but I got mine free through the disability resource programs of the state. So if you look, go to your Bureau of Services to the Blind, Dyslexic, and Low Vision, they can, depending on the state and the budget, they can provide computers, training, software, hardware, things like this.
Very nice. Yeah, I just looked at Zoom Tech, $600.
Yeah.
That's
now,
amazing.
He might be able to get that free if his Bureau of Services to the Blind offers has that in their budgets, which Nevada did,
nice.
Where I live.
Nice.
Now, you were talking about artificial intelligence, and you and I have talked before on Colossus, the Forbin
yes.
project.
I have it on my hard drive. I keep meaning to watch it.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned machine learning, that's where it's headed. Now, remember that Dave was locked out from Hal.
Yeah.
In this 40-year-old movie, humanity was locked out because
right.
of machine learning. It went to the ultimate. So the American computer linked up with the Russian computer and controlled all of humanity.
Yeah, this is the voice of master control.
Yeah, and that's a lot far beyond just Hal locking out Dave. But then another aspect of this is from the movie War Games, the
right.
inability of AI to discern false positives and false right. negatives.
The only way to play, the only way to win is not to play, I think was the,
yeah.
the motto of War Games.
Whole nuclear war.
Yeah, this. Thank you for reminding me to look at the scroll feature of the... it's working again because, yeah, you do have to go into accessibility here. I'll show you. It's really nice. I use this used to use this all the time during the shows because I could zoom in, you know, like that. And I think if you had trouble reading, a Mac is a really good solution because you can show a web page and zoom in like that. And then I guess, let me see. Yeah, the arrow keys work to position. So I can make this this text as big as the screen pretty much. You know, you should be able to read that. Oh, and the scroll also works if you're not holding control, so you can go up and down. And then it's very easy to scroll in and out. So I'm holding down the control key to scroll in and out. That's great. Thanks for reminding me that works still. I had, you know, it used to be on by default, I guess, or maybe I just forgot to turn it on every time. I don't know, or I forgot that I had to turn it on. That's actually pretty, that's a pretty funny Mother's Day. Am I a good mother, Susan? My name's Amy. But we're making pie. My name's Amy. Jim in Las Vegas.
Hello.
Thanks for hanging on. What can I do for you?
Yeah, Leo, I have just under a terabyte of DVDs, and I have two questions. One, why do I have to rip them to a NAS, for example, as opposed to copy?
You actually don't. So if you copy them, and you know there are those VOB files and the VTS files, you actually can make a copy of the DVD that will have all of the menu structure, everything that you see when you play the DVD. You just need software that plays it properly. And it's probable that the NAS doesn't have software that serves it up to whatever you're playing it back on properly. It just, in other words, it's a capability, a software capability that's missing, I would expect, in your NAS.
I was thinking of using Plex for the media servers. And
Plex can do it. Plex can do it.
Well, that the Amazon Alexa can invoke or select the
right
the movies. So
yeah, I'm pretty sure. So the, so if you copied the entire DVD off of the disc, and it is just a data disc, you've copied all the data from the DVD disc into a folder, named it with that movie, that Plex would then be able to treat it exactly as if it were that disc.
Okay.
If you wanted just to have a single file that you play back, that's when you rip it and often re-encode it into MPEG-4 because it's MPEG-2 on a DVD, often re-encode it. And then, you know, some software would require it. But I think that Plex, I'm pretty sure Plex would be able to, let's see. Oh, wait a minute. No, Plex does not support it. That is too bad. So they for reasons I don't fully understand, won't do it. Now, you can do it on your computer. If you copy the DVD directly to your computer and use the DVD player program and open that file folder, even VLC would do that. It would treat it as if it were the DVD. But apparently they say, Plex says, it just doesn't fit into the idea behind the Plex ecosystem. Okay. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. That's too bad. That's a that and a reason Plex gives for this is that you play back stuff from a variety of places on Plex, and it doesn't make sense to have a DVD interface on your Android device, for instance, and stuff like that. Simply put, these formats just don't fit into the idea behind the Plex ecosystem. They hide content built behind built-in menu systems. Not only would the menus add extra UI the user would need to wade through to get to the content, but there simply isn't any good way they could be presented in the myriad different Plex apps that are available from iOS to Android, from the web browser to Roku. That's not, I mean, I don't buy it, but that's what they say. They don't like the UI. So for Plex, you do have to rip it, create a MP4 or some similar file that they can play back. That's disappointing. But a lot of things will play back. You could create an ISO file of the DVD, for instance, and there are many things that would play that back. Yeah, I'm not talking about playing VOB files directly. I'm talking about just copying the entire DVD over. VLC will read a DVD. If you copied the DVD onto your hard drive as a folder, you could open that folder in VLC and it would play just like the DVD. Yeah, Mike, I'm not... Again, Mike, that's not what we're talking about. I know you could play back VOB files, but he says, I don't want to... I mean, I guess you could just copy the VOB files only. So I guess that might be what he's saying. I think it's a mistake that, you don't need to just copy the VOB files. If you're using VLC, you can copy the whole folder and open that folder directly. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, moving on to line one. Laurie, Palmer Springs, California. Hi, Laurie.
Hi, Leo. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Thanks for calling. What can I do for you?
Well, Leo, I have this major problem. I have a business, and we had a website live on Google Everything for the past 4 years. A couple of weeks ago, I asked an IT guy at my work to go in and make a couple of changes. Now, my website is completely offline.
You can't go to it in your browser?
No.
Okay.
No,
now, understand there's two different issues here. There's Google, which is your... Where was your site? Was it on Google? Was it Google?
It was on Google.
It was like a Blogspot site?
No, it's our business website.
It was on Google website. Business. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what were the changes the IT guy made?
I have no idea. When we went down, when I scrolled down on the bottom of the website, I saw my AdWords showed up.
Okay.
So I talked to him about it, and I said, can you go hide those? Because I really didn't want those showing. So he went in and he tried to do something, and now the website is completely gone.
You need a better IT guy.
No kidding. I'm going to lock him out. I don't even know how to do that.
Oh, boy. So I'm not, I don't know what he did, but it's very easy to take a site off offline with a whole number of different things. So let me, what was the site address?
You want me to give you that online?
Well, unless you don't want anybody to know. I mean, it is a business, right? You don't mind people know
it
what you're...
It is a business. I don't mind. It was JB3HVAC.com.
JB3HVAC.com.
Yes.
I just want to see who owns that. So that's part of... Yeah, I can see it's not coming up, is it? You know, it's just hard for me to say exactly what he did that broke it. And I take it you he doesn't know, or you've asked him and he doesn't know?
Oh, he knows.
Oh, he doesn't like you. Oh, he's mad at you.
No, I'm mad at him. He's saying that he's going to fix it, but it's been days now that I haven't been able to get my website back on. And honestly, I'm not a techie person, so I don't know how to do it myself.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I know how to do it, but I don't know what's wrong. So, and I don't have the keys to the kingdom, so to speak. Let me just see. You're registered with GoDaddy.
Yes.
So did he modify your GoDaddy DNS settings or anything? You know, I mean, I don't know what he did is the problem.
Can I ask you, is it fixable? I mean,
oh, yeah.
Have to have a
compulsive. Oh, guarantee you it's fixable unless he, you know, I mean... Maybe he went to the web host and said, please delete this entire site and make it.
Oh, my God.
So he could do that, and then it wouldn't be fixable. Actually, it might even be fixable. I guess, so who's serving the site? Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yes, I do know what you mean. And it is a white label up in Canada that's serving my site.
That's who you need to call.
And I did. And they said it's live on their end. And then I thought... Oh my gosh! Maybe GoDaddy took me down. Maybe I did.
Well, no. If it's live,
that's good.
So they said it's live in there, and they didn't mean that they can go to it in a browser, but they mean
they're
serving it.
Yes.
Okay. Then the next place to go is GoDaddy, because it is possible, and I suspect this is what the guy did, to modify your GoDaddy record so that it no longer, you know, GoDaddy owns or not owns, but was the registrar of record for JB3HVAC.com. So at GoDaddy, they have something called a DNS record. That is a phone, basically the phone book entry that says when people type in JB3HVAC.com, here's what you do. You go to that white label in Canada. Well, if he broke that, then people will type in JB3HVAC.com and get what I get, which is this site can't be reached.
Right.
And that's because, well, it could be for a lot of reasons. As long as the site's being served, and I'm going to take the Canadian guy's word for it, it's being served, then that means that it's almost certain that the IT guy broke the connection, broke the phone book lookup at GoDaddy. So
okay.
Do you is it your GoDaddy account?
Yes.
Okay. So log into your GoDaddy account.
Okay.
And now I'm not going to walk you through fixing the DNS record, but I would look at the DNS record for it and see if it's pointing to the white label company in Canada.
Okay.
Because that's what it needs to do. He may have, you know, if he changed it by one number by accident, you know, fat fingered it, it wouldn't work anymore.
Okay.
So that, I suspect, is what's wrong. Now, you probably can get help from the Canadian company at fixing the GoDaddy DNS record because they know what to do. Okay, somebody just tried your IP address. I don't know how they got it, but they said that doesn't work either. So I'm not sure what's – no. I'm sorry. Forget it. That's somebody who doesn't know what they're doing in the chat room. Sometimes the chat room gives me suggestions that are nonsense. This is what I'm almost certain has happened. If the site is being served, but you can't get to it, then that means that your domain name is not properly set up.
Okay.
So I don't know if you did it yourself or you had somebody to do it, but when you first set up a website, what you do is you get a host, a computer somewhere, can be in Canada, doesn't matter, that has all the content of JB3HVAC.com on it, has all the pages, the photos, and all that stuff. They run something called a web server, which is software that makes that available. And they have a number. There's a specific number, 168.7.4.3 or whatever it is, that is the number of JB3HVAC.com. But that number, nobody's going to enter in that number directly. So what people do is they enter in the name, and that name then goes to GoDaddy, And GoDaddy says, oh, you want this number. If that got broken, nobody will get to your website.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
My website was up for 4 years, and all of a sudden, it's missing.
Oh, now somebody's saying JB3. Oh, this is interesting. I'm getting some conflicting. I'm just going to try something. No. Never mind. Again, it's sometimes I get the wrong answer from the chat room. I think if you understand the logic of what I just said, then I think that somewhere along that chain of custody, you know, from the Canadian host where your data is, the software that they're running to serve the data up at that particular IP address that they offer, somewhere along the line, that connection to JB3 HVAC has been severed, almost certainly at GoDaddy.
Now, if I change my server, will it automatically? Somebody just has to put a new code in there, right, to get me back up online, right? If I decide to take it away from the white label that's up in Canada?
Yeah. That's why you use a registrar.
Okay.
So the is it J as in James Burns, or is JB?
Yes.
J as in JB,
yes.
And the number 3, HVAC. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just, because the chat room is trying some other name, but I did a look up on that one and I see it at GoDaddy, so I think I've got the right one.
Okay.
It's just a question of GoDaddy hooking it up. And that's why you go through GoDaddy. You can have GoDaddy point to anybody. So if you decided, so the first thing to do, by the way, call that Canadian company, say, I would like a backup copy of the data that's on your server. That you can take and move anywhere.
Okay.
And you should have that anyway. That way, worst case, the whole thing goes up in smoke. You can go to some other web hosting company, put your data there, go to GoDaddy, say, point to this server, and you're back online.
Wonderful. Leo, thank you so much.
All right. Nice to talk to you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Have a good day.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls right after this.
Sharon.
That's your fault. And you know, it's not their fault. They didn't hear it correctly. So PS Chop Strike, JV HVAC info is up. It's not JVAC info. It's not that site. It's J. Okay. I shouldn't really ever pay attention. It's JB3HVAC.com. Archive.org has it? Really?
They have hearts of gold, Leo.
Oh, I know they're trying to help.
Golden lead.
So actually, if you can find it on the Wayback Machine, which you can, that's handy because she could get the content from the Wayback Machine at least, right? So let me show you that. That's actually a very useful little tip. Thank you, Mike. So you go to archive.org. I'll put up the screen here. And you type in her domain name. See, what they do is they copy stuff over. So JB3HVAC.com. They copy stuff over onto their servers. And you see we have a bunch of pages from 2016 and 2018. Let's go to 2018. And they, in January 18th, they copied the site. So I can go see it on the Wayback Machine. So there's her site. And so that means she could go and download this, you know, the content and have it, because that's the same content. But it's not being served from the Canadians. It's being served from the archives of archive.org. So there you go. Oh, mama. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 asked Leo. We did a little digging. You know, I don't know if you know this, but when you have a website, a lot of information can be gleaned about you. Because she gave out her website address, I could look it up and find out that GoDaddy was her registrar. And also, her host was a company called Liquid Web, but I think the IT guy was up to no good. Because I noticed that the name servers, the phone book that GoDaddy refers to now is a Mexican company. called MicroBit. So maybe he pasted in something accidentally from another client. Maybe he intentionally changed it and messed it up. But that's what happened. And so I think the clear and easy fix is to either go to GoDaddy and ask for their help. They should be able to help you. Or get a new IT guy and have him help you. 8888. Oh, I shouldn't laugh. That's terrible. Especially if it's a business, right? Your business is down. This is part of the problem, of course, with technology is that we're a little bit at the mercy of the people who understand it. It was always my mission. I mean, this is why I started doing this 40 years ago, writing about it and later doing radio and TV shows about technology. Is if you don't understand it, you're at the mercy of anybody who does understand it. And as technology, and I mean, I saw this decades ago, becomes more and more important in our life, it's fairly critical, I think, that we have some literacy in this area. So we at least know the right questions to ask, the right people to find. And when something goes wrong, we kind of understand what went wrong. That's really what I try to do on this show. Because I think it's important that, you know, this is your best defense is some knowledge. So I thank you for listening. I appreciate it. Dave, Ridgecrest, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Dave.
Oh, hello?
Hello.
Yeah, hi. I have a comment on a couple of vision-impaired people. There's another device that they can get, and it's the Microsoft IntelliMouse, and it's very cheap. I also have a XP running upstairs. I've got one on that, and I've got a Mac downstairs.
You mean like this mouse I'm holding in my hand? I love the IntelliMouse. I use it. It's actually I'm using it on a Mac. I use it on all my computers. But yeah. How does that help with accessibility?
Well, I'm not sure exactly. I would have to go back and look at the disk that came with it, I think. I don't remember how we got it installed.
Okay, but the mouse itself isn't doing anything. It's got software that lets you do magnifiers.
Is, I think.
Okay.
But because it's too, although you may be right,
I know what's going on here because I have it and I use it. The mouse doesn't do anything, but there may be some software that came with it. The good news, it's built into Windows, all Windows machines. But it is my favorite mouse, by the way. It's a great mouse. They're inexpensive. They're robust. I've been using, you know, I have actually a bunch of them in cold storage in my in my cupboard at home. I have three or four IntelliMouse in the box. Just in case, because when a mouse goes bad, you need a mouse. You need one fast. Hey, thank you. I appreciate, Dave, thanks for the call. Ann in Oceanside, California. Hi, Ann. Leo Laporte. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Okay, I have a question about opening PDF, I guess. Like if I go on wanting to open a newsletter, you know, I'm on the internet and or a journal article or something like that, and the bar comes up and it says, do you want to open or save, for example, AmericanMedicalJournal.pdf, and I
right.
click open, all I get is just a blank page.
Yeah. So what you must be using Internet Explorer. That's my guess is your browser.
Oh, I am using Internet Explorer.
Yeah, I knew you were. It's not the problem. It's just that any modern browser will automatically open it up. But Internet Explorer needs what we call a helper to read PDFs. Now, you can download a helper. You've probably seen this before, the Adobe Acrobat Reader.
Yeah,
that's a helper that will help you read PDFs. So on older versions of Windows, before this became kind of commonplace, built into the operating system, people would download Acrobat Reader. So that's probably the best thing for you to do with Windows 8.1.
Oh, okay.
If you use, you do have another browser on there called Edge, that will open it up and read it. You don't need any additional help.
Now, how would I get, I'm very computer illiterate. How would I start using Edge? Is that similar to
you're on Windows 8.1, I understand. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's there. It comes from Microsoft. Microsoft, it's a little confusing. They put two browsers on there. They want you to use Edge, but they continue to offer Internet Explorer for people who are used to it. If Is there no Edge in Windows 8.1? Is that the case? Oh, man. Well, you can download it. Mm-hmm. I thought they put, didn't they? I was sure they had Edge in Windows 8.1. It's Windows 10 only? All right. Will it, I'm talking to the chat room now. Mike mm-hmm. B is saying there's no Edge on Windows 8.1. Will it run on Windows 8.1? Because if it would, that would solve it. If it won't, you're going to have to download something anyway. Might as well just go to adobe.com and download the free Acrobat Reader.
Okay. And that should do it then.
Yeah. And then what'll happen is when you get to those pages with .pdf, Reader will pop up. You won't have to do anything extra. Reader will just pop up, and you'll read it in the Reader.
Oh, thank you.
My pleasure.
Happy Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day to you.
Thanks. Bye.
I'm not one, but I bet you are. Happy Mother's Day to everybody who's a mother listening. Last call of the day. Brian Grass Valley. Hello, Brian. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo.
Hello.
Great to talk to you.
Thanks for calling. What can I do for you?
So happy you're back from vacation.
I am too. Well, yeah, I am. I love vacation, yeah. But a good vacation, means I'm usually pretty happy to be back too.
Awesome.
Thank you. What can I do for you?
So I have a workshop probably 60, 70 feet away from the house, and I need to extend my Wi-Fi out there.
Yeah.
Right now, if I leave the back door open and I leave the shop door open, and I do have a good router and modem, both of them I bought on your recommendation.
Good.
It'll get out there, but yeah. It's not super reliable that
yeah.
way.
Yeah, you're just distant
I
enough.
I can run a LAN cable out there.
That would be the best, but do you want a wire yeah. hanging in the, from...
It doesn't matter. It's not that big of a deal. If that's the best way to do it, then that's the way I want to do it.
Well, it's the most reliable, unless you put the lawnmower over it. It's certainly the fastest. But a lot of people don't want to do that because they just don't want to string a wire from one building to another. How far away did you say it was?
Probably 60 or 70 feet.
Yeah, and that's why it works with the door open. If you had line of sight from your Wi-Fi access point to that building... to the computer in that building, you would have no trouble. Wi-Fi will go about 100, 150 feet. But whenever there's stuff in the way, windows, doors, walls, it attenuates the signal, and that means it's a little worse. I think the best thing to do would be string a wire. If you can do that, maybe dig it into the ground, put a conduit in the ground, or is it on the same power box as the rest of the house? Because you can also use
that's
something.
The other thing, it's got a separate
power. Though. Yeah, string a LAN wire. That's certainly the best way. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Yeah, I mean, there are, there are Wi-Fi boosters and extenders and antennas and all sorts of other ways to do it, but none of them work as well as a LAN cable. So you feel like you wouldn't mind doing that?
No, that's not a problem at all to string a LAN cable out there. But I'm just wondering, I wouldn't use a second router, though, would I?
No. Your router has an extra LAN port on it, probably, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You just plug it into that, get the wire across to the other building. That's going to give you absolutely the best speed. It'll give you better speed than the Wi-Fi in the house, probably.
Yep.
And 60 feet for Ethernet is not a big deal. No trouble.
No, but I was just wondering, what's the device I'm going to use to plug in out in the
shop? You want Wi-Fi in the shop?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. I mean, you could plug it into a computer, and it would really give you great speed. If you want Wi-Fi out in the shop, there are lots of different Wi-Fi. Let's see. What would be the best way to extend that out? What you want, essentially, is something that's not a router, just the Wi-Fi radio. So you could get a cheap router, put it in bridge mode. That would work fine. Any router, any Wi-Fi device would probably work just fine. You plug the Ethernet into the back. Let's say you got a $40 Linksys router, right? You plug the Ethernet cable.
Laying around.
Yeah, I bet you do. Oh, well, then you're set. You just plug the cable into the back of that as if it's the cable to your Internet. Yep. And the only trick is that you want to put that extra router in something called bridge mode. It's not going to do routing. It's just going to be a radio.
Okay, and so then
you go in the settings of the Wi-Fi router, of the extended router, yep. and then just turn off turn off DHCP or turn on bridge mode. Most of them it says turn on bridge mode.
Okay, and then whatever devices I use out there, my Fire Stick, my phone, whatever, just put them on that network.
Yeah. It'll
be a separate network.
You could have a different name for it, or you could use the same name and password if you want, which is easiest.
Yep. Okay.
All right.
Well, that's exactly what I do then.
Yeah. Well, that's the best way to do it if you can, yeah.
Okay. Can I ask you one more thing real quick?
Sure. Why not?
Okay. On my Chrome browser that I use on my, you know, my Pixel phone, of the Pixel XL, the first one, these annoying, I don't know if they're fake, the Facebook pop-ups that say congratulations and tries to get you to play some game or something.
Yeah, they're...
what do I do to stop that?
It's on a Chromebook?
No, I have a Chromebook. That it doesn't do it on the Chromebook.
Oh, okay. Browser. Oh, okay.
On the phone browser.
Oh, on the Android phone.
Yep.
And it's only in the browser? You're not in the game itself? Because games will do that all the time. I really hate
No,
that.
I don't even have Facebook, but it continues to pop this one up. And then it puts up like a fake roulette wheel or something.
Oh, God, I hate that. So the site you're going to is the site you're going to is almost certainly popping that up. What you might want
to... on multiple sites. It'll even do it on MLB. It'll do...
Oh, that's not good. Okay.
No.
What kind? It's an Android device?
Yeah, it's a Pixel XL, the first one.
Oh. Well...
Great phone, by the way.
Yeah, you got something on there, it sounds like. Because it shouldn't, certainly MLB would not have a roulette wheel popping up saying, play our game. Certainly not.
Because it with all different websites.
Yeah, there's something on there. Let me think about this. I don't know of Android. And you're using the Chrome browser that comes with the phone?
That's the only browser I use, yeah.
Wow. Let me look and see if there's Android pop-ups. It's an infection. But I don't know how you would get it on Android. You must... You know what? Probably... You're pretty careful about...
I don't have Facebook installed. I don't even use it.
No, no. It's not coming from Facebook. That's...
Some fake junk.
It's junk. And it's not coming from MLB.com, almost certainly. So that means you...
It's different. It's all different websites.
Yeah. You have something installed on your phone... Probably you downloaded unwittingly an app that does it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would look carefully through your apps that you've installed and uninstall anything you don't need. Stay away from cheesy things like wallpaper apps, stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I normally do.
Yeah, almost certainly. The reason I say this is there's no way MLB, a reliable site, is popping up this roulette wheel. And you've seen the same pop-up everywhere.
Yep.
Yeah. It's coming.
A variation, but it's almost always the same. Some fake Facebook game, you know, roulette or something. Yeah.
It's almost certainly coming from an app that you put on the phone.
Yeah.
So you need to figure out what app it is. I would just uninstall anything you don't need. You can go into the Play Store, the App Store, and look at all of the apps that you have downloaded in chronological order. And that will give you some idea, probably, since this is this recent or has it been going on forever?
You know, it's been off and on.
Yeah, that's typical. So what happens is you install an app that is, you know, nominally a normal app. You know, the Tide Table. Let's say it's a Tide Tables app. And it's, you know, does the Tide Tables. But what you don't know is it's also popping stuff up all over your phone. And so sometimes happens because the guy who wrote the Tide Tables app is malicious. Sometimes it happens because he's using a library that's malicious. It's not even his fault. But whatever it is, the only way you can get that on an Android phone is by installing something. So you need to figure out what happens when you install it.
Okay.
Some sites pop that stuff up, but you're getting the same pop-up on multiple sites, even sites like MLB that don't pop up things, then it's not coming from the browser. I don't think you can install browser extensions on Chrome on Android.
That was going to be my next question.
Yeah, I mean, if we're on the desktop, it could easily be a browser, what they call a browser hijacker object.
Yes.
An extension on the browser. But I don't think you can do that. As far as I know, you can't do that on Android Chrome.
Okay. And maybe someone in the chat room is having a similar problem and can find a solution or already has a solution, yeah, I'll check there too.
I think I would almost, without a doubt, guess that it's some app you installed. And it might not be obviously a bad app. It might be something that seems reasonable, but it's coming from
there. Yeah, it's just really annoying.
Yeah. No, you shouldn't have that. I have a Pixel. I don't see that. You shouldn't be seeing that. That's there's something on your phone. I mean, you know, if you in the long run you can't get rid of it, wipe your phone and then judiciously reinstall your apps.
Now, can I do a wipe with this phone similar to the Power Wash with the Chromebook?
Well, it's similar except that it is a Power Wash, but it doesn't restore anything. So it will restore, like Google's keeping track of what apps you have installed, so it will reinstall your apps, except that you maybe don't want it to if it's coming from an app. But yeah, it's kind of like a Power Wash, except that you can have data on your phone that isn't backed up and stored elsewhere. On the Chromebook, most of the time, okay, with the Power Wash, you just log onto your Chrome account and your Google account, and everything's back. Okay. On the Google phone,
I'll go through all the apps.
Yeah, if you have music and photos on that phone, make sure they get backed up before you do it.
Yeah, everything's in the cloud.
Oh, as long as it's in the cloud, wipe the phone.
That's what I'll do then.
Yeah, that'll fix it for sure.
Great, Leo. I really, really appreciate it.
Anytime. My pleasure. Have a good one.
Thanks again. Bye.
No, I like the name Power Wash. Don't you think that's a good name? I think it's a good name. He doesn't need an ad blocker. That's not the problem. Chrome, it's not coming from Chrome. It's coming from something else. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy Show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, it's just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows on the Netcast Network. It's called TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on. And on. You even get your daily dose of tech news with Tech News Today. And of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guy show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.